Welcome back, everybody. This is the Academic Pediatrics Podcast. We're the Journal of the Academic Pediatric Association and the Association of Pediatric Program Directors. This podcast is here to connect you with the authors, with the editors, to build our community around academic pediatric practice and inform our clinical, educational, research, and advocacy practice. Today, we're talking about qualitative methods. We're talking with a bunch of our editors in the education section, and I'm very happy to have Dr. Melissa Klein leading the effort here and interviewing some really great guests. Dr. Klein, thanks so much for taking this on.
Thank you, Mike, for having us. So we're going to go ahead and start off by introducing ourselves. So hello, everyone. I'm Melissa Klein. I'm a professor of pediatrics at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. And for the journal, my role is an associate editor of medical education.
I'm Siting Lee. I'm a professor of pediatrics at the University of California, Davis. And for the journal, I'm associate editor for medical education for academic pediatrics.
And I'm Sarah Hilgenberg, a clinical associate professor of pediatric hospital medicine at Stanford. And for the journal, I'm an associate editor of The View from APPD.
So we're looking forward to a really interesting discussion today on qualitative research. We're going to frame our discussion around the article, A Qualitative Exploration of Pediatric Resident Perceptions of Autonomy in the Era of Pediatric Hospital Medicine Fellowships by Goldstein et al., that was recently published in our journal, Academic Pediatrics. I'm going to start us off with just a brief synopsis of this article. So this manuscript explores pediatric senior residents' perceptions of autonomy, described as the ability to act on one's own volition when working with fellows on a pediatric hospital medicine team. As many of you are already aware, PHM, or pediatric hospital medicine fellowships, are relatively new, rapidly expanding, and introduce a fellow supervisor into teams that were often resident-led. In addition, residents have reported decreased autonomy when working with PHM fellows rather than working with attendings alone. Thus, this article addresses a gap in the literature about how to foster pediatric resident development of autonomy when working with PHM fellows. The authors grounded their thematic analysis in self-determination theory, as autonomy, competence, and relatedness can drive resident engagement and initiative, and a loss of this autonomy may negatively impact their motivation. Using purposeful sampling, the authors conducted semi-structured interviews with 17 senior residents at one institution. The authors coded as they continued to collect data and continued to code until several transcripts generated no new codes, suggesting they reached thematic sufficiency. The authors then identified four key themes with seven sub-themes describing resident experiences of autonomy. The authors then scaffolded these themes on an organizing framework adapted from Bronfenbrenner's ecological model, which I will herefore call BEM model. I will briefly explain the BEM model to those who are unfamiliar with it, as it is new in medical education. The BEM model suggests that human development is influenced by one's direct environment, called the microsystem, as well as multiple levels surrounding the environment and their interactions, which are referred to as the mesosystem, the exosystem, and the macrosystem. The authors did not characterize that final characterization, the chronosystem, as that would describe changes over time and would require a follow-up or longitudinal study. This BEM framework helped the authors describe factors related to resident-fellow interactions, as well as complex factors related to attending fellow dynamics and the cultural context. Finally, the authors proposed several best practice recommendations that institutions may consider to optimize team dynamics and resident autonomy. These recommendations include suggestions for fellows, attendings, fellow attending dyad relationships, as well as GME program directors. So the authors also shared several limitations, which we will discuss. These limitations included only senior resident perspectives that were explored. Data was not triangulated with other outcomes. All authors have an affiliation with PHM, which may have shaped their data interpretation, a concept called reflexivity, and that results may have limited transferability to residents at other institutions. So now we're going to switch to some question and answer and discussion about qualitative research in a more general way. And we're going to keep refer back to this article as a way to keep us centered and grounded. So Suting, I'm going to turn to you to start. So as you know, is your role as an associate editor for education of our journal, we're receiving more educational research manuscripts that use qualitative analysis. When do you think authors should consider using qualitative analysis?
So I think overall that methods should address the research question in general. So research questions about understanding a participant's perspectives or experiences or understanding how or why an educational intervention works are really a good fit with qualitative methods. In this case, the authors were interested in understanding senior resident perspectives about pediatric hospital medicine fellow behaviors, which could impact senior resident autonomy. And this is a great fit with qualitative methods.
Thank you, Suting. Another question for you. As an editor or a reviewer, what are the key areas in a qualitative study that you look for when you are reviewing these types of studies?
So my three key areas that I consider are the importance of the question, methodological rigor, and the significance of the result. So I'll talk a little bit more about each of these. So the importance of the question. So just because a question has never been studied before does not mean that it's important enough or interesting enough to study and publish. So it's important for authors to set up in the introduction the importance of the research question by clearly describing what is known in the literature, the gap in the literature, why it's important to fill that gap, and how this study actually fills that gap. Moving on to methodological rigor, authors establish methodological rigor by establishing trustworthiness. And they do this through doing rigorous methods that maximize transferability, credibility, dependability, and confirmability. And I'll talk about each of these. Hansen et al.'s 2011 Academic Pediatrics article on qualitative research methods for medical educators has great information about these four elements of rigor, as does Frombach's 2013 Academic Medicine AM last page, so one pager on qualitative criteria and qualitative and quantitative research. So starting with transferability, which can also be thought of as external validity. Similar to generalizability in quantitative settings, transferability is the extent to which results can be applicable to other settings. Authors establish transferability by giving detailed descriptions or thick descriptions of the study's participants and settings. And that allows readers to determine whether results are actually applicable to their own setting. Single site studies like this study may make transferability more challenging, as senior residents who interact with PHM fellows on only some PHM rotations may have a different perspective than senior residents in an institution where senior residents interact with PHM fellows on all PHM rotations. Or perhaps there's differences in terms of other things that PHM fellows and senior residents may feel and may have different interactions. Second one I'd like to talk about is credibility, which can be thought of as internal validity or the extent to which results are believable to others. So one way of establishing credibility would be to gather data from multiple sources or to use multiple methods to gather data, like interviews and observations. So that could be triangulation. While the authors did not utilize triangulation, they did utilize member checking. So they asked research participants if the themes which emerged or which they identified were consistent with what the participants experienced. The third area of rigor is dependability, can be thought of as reliability, so consistency of result. Ways of increasing dependability include using more than one coder and peer debriefing, where researchers discuss codes and themes. In this study, all transcripts were coded by two coders, and codes were discussed amongst the research team. The last element of rigor I'd like to talk about is confirmability, thought of as objectivity. So audio recording interviews, leaving an audit trail, allows others to verify the rigor of the study. And in this study, all interviews were audio recorded and transcribed. And then lastly, I'd like to talk about the significance of the results. Really thinking about how do these findings contribute to or expand upon what is already known in the literature? And then what are those implications of those findings on medical education? You want a study that is actually going to have some impact on those things. Sarah, did you have other things to add?
Yeah. So in addition to what Suting has discussed, we also want to make sure that listeners understand that there are other essential components to a qualitative study, particularly as they relate to methodologic rigor, such as philosophical frameworks, conceptual models, and appropriate analytic approaches. However, we will not be addressing these for the purposes of this particular podcast.
So thank you for sharing that. My next question is related to interviews versus focus groups. So clearly in this study, the authors chose to do interviews. As one approach is a qualitative study, how would you advise the choice between interviews and focus groups?
So as I consider interviews versus focus groups, I know that individual interviews really allow you to have more in-depth understanding of a single participant's perspective without others influencing them. And this is particularly important when discussing sensitive issues. It's also often easier to find time to speak with one participant at a time than it is to find a time when groups of participants are all available to participate in a focus group. Focus groups, on the other hand, allow participants to react and incorporate other participants' responses and build on each other's responses. A focus group of 6 to 8 participants also will take less time to do than doing 6 to 8 individual interviews, and it's also less expensive to conduct. Sarah, what else do you consider when you're preparing for interviews or focus groups?
So psychological safety and power dynamics are really essential to consider. As such, the choice and training of the interviewer or focus group facilitator is key. This person should not be in a position of power over the others, where coercion, for example, could be a concern at play. So let's think back to this study. The interviewers included resident investigators without PHM fellowship affiliation to try to minimize bias or conflict of interests or significant power dynamics. So that seems like an effective approach with this particular study. We can imagine a study design where PHM attendings who regularly teach and assess residents are the interviewers or facilitators, and how this could be inappropriate for this study population, which in this situation is pediatric residents. So in addition, it's important to ensure that all participants have time and space to share their perspective. In our experience, sometimes one participant's voice may dominate, and so the facilitator should be skilled at navigating this, and the guide can be written in such a way as to invite everyone to respond in turn, and particularly important that this is done at the beginning of the session. And last, the interviewer or facilitator should also understand when and how to probe for more information.
Great. So I'd like to switch now to a discussion around sampling. So in this study, the authors used purposeful sampling to interview senior residents. So what does purposeful sampling mean? And then what are the benefits and drawbacks to this approach?
So purposeful sampling means intentionally choosing participants who have experience with what you're interested in. So in this case, senior residents with experience working with PHM fellows. The benefit of purposeful sampling is that it allows the researcher to include participants with experience relevant to their research question. However, the risk here is that the breadth of experience may not be representative of the entire population. So in other words, the researcher is not explicitly seeking out participants with very different perspectives. Sampling choice has implications for what we talked about before as the transferability of the study's results, and will also relate to our upcoming discussion on thematic saturation versus sufficiency. Suting, what would you add?
So I also think that sampling methods can be combined. So for example, the authors could purposefully sample senior residents with experience working with PHM fellows, but also sample for maximal variation through small snowball sampling. So combining these three techniques. Maximal variation includes looking for senior residents with potentially different experiences by explicitly inviting diverse perspectives, looking for senior residents of different gender, race, ethnicity. The authors might also want to explicitly include residents with poor experiences with working with PHM fellows and residents with good experiences working with PHM fellows. This could be done through snowball sampling, So after each interview, the authors could ask the participant to recommend, who else should I interview? Maybe there's somebody that has a different experience than you do that you would recommend. Sampling also, as Sarah said, ties back to transferability. Is the breadth of participants sampled in the study wide enough that results could be applicable to other institutions?
So in this study, the authors discussed that they use semi-structured interview guides. This type of description may be different to those that are experienced with quantitative research. So Ting, can you explain why this is an important in qualitative research?
So in quantitative research, we're thinking about a survey. Questions are exactly the same for all participants. And a structured interview would be similar to a survey where questions are exactly the same for all participants. However, in qualitative research, you want to be able to explore more and have it be a little bit more iterative. So semi-structured interviews allow the interviewer to ask questions within a predetermined theme, but also allow the interviewer to ask additional probing questions as needed to better explore the participant's experiences and perspectives.
And importantly, we can change the interview guides as data is collected and analyzed, and folks realize that they may want to further explore an area. So this is different than how we typically think about quantitative research approaches.
So in the methods, the authors commented that they coded while they continued to interview residents until sufficiency was reached. Sharing how one reaches sufficiency versus saturation is key to establishing rigor in a qualitative study. Can you explain how the authors knew that they had reached sufficiency? And Sarah, since you've already kind of started to comment on sufficiency, can you also comment on how does sufficiency differ from saturation?
Sufficiency is a newer concept on the scene that I haven't seen fully adopted yet, though I really love the shift toward this term and what it embodies within qualitative research and our limits as researchers. Saturation has been considered the point at which interviews or focus groups aren't generating any new information, or when the study team thinks that they have, quote unquote, heard it all. It implies an endpoint. However, the term can be misused or employed prematurely and has been a difficult point to determine in a study and for researchers to defend. The default description of saturation often relies on conveyance of an adequate number of interviews to convince an audience that they've done enough. In other words, this approach introduces significant subjectivity, like much of qualitative research as compared to quantitative. In looking for depth of a topic, breadth may not be fully captured, as we've alluded to before, especially depending on the sampling strategy. So some even argue that reaching saturation just isn't possible. Hence a shift to replacing the idea of saturation with sufficiency, where researchers determine that they may not have, quote unquote, heard it all, but have heard enough. What I like about this concept is that it acknowledges potential limitations in gathering every possible piece of information and conveys that there may be more, yet that the researchers have generated enough rich data in a rigorous way to make their claims.
That was really helpful. Thank you, Sarah. So Ting, I have another question for you. So we know that sample size and power calculations are very important in quantitative studies. Are these important in qualitative research as well?
So I'd really like to amplify a point that Sarah made earlier, that qualitative research is iterative. So qualitative researchers don't and can't and shouldn't calculate sample size and power. And it's not necessarily the number of participants interviewed, but the richness and quality of the data gathered that's important. So we want to continue to gather and analyze that data until really the researchers believe that there's no new insights that they can gather from this, and it's sufficient to answer their interesting research question.
So how do researchers know that they have reached sufficiency?
I think sufficiency is tough because of that. I think it's a newer concept that's come out. And I think because of that, it's like lots of qualitative research, it's not objective. It's subjective. But part of that is that reflexivity from the author. So if they believe that's sufficient to answer the research question, then it's sufficient. And that makes it tough for reviewers, because if a reviewer looks at it and they're like, well, I don't think that's sufficient to answer the question, then you have a disagreement there. And I think that is tough. I don't know, Sarah and Melissa, if you have additional thoughts on that as well.
So I agree. I think sufficiency is being a bit humble compared to saturation is saying we know we've gotten every perspective. And sufficiency is saying, based on our research group's perspectives and our reflex and acknowledging our reflexivity in this work, we think we have enough of enough information to develop the outcome, the themes that we've come to. We don't think we will find more, but being humble and the fact is that we can't truly say we've saturated and there is no more truth out there.
The insights that you gather, that you have enough insights in this. So if you have gathered a lot of information or some information and you're like, oh, this is sufficient, but there's no actual real new insights that come from that, that may be really hard to justify.
And I think quantitative, we often are looking for like that one truth, and qualitative, we know there's not just one truth. And so we have saturated the insights that we have gotten based on, you know, knowing that there's many different ways of truth. I'd like to switch next to conversation around reflexivity. So what is the role of reflexivity in qualitative research? And how do you actually share this in a manuscript?
So unlike in quantitative research, where we really try to be as objective as possible, in qualitative research, the researchers themselves are an important part of the research process because they're integral to interpreting the data and they actually put themselves in there as a piece of that. So reflexivity means acknowledging and examining how your prior experiences, assumptions, or beliefs may influence your interpretation of the data. So in this study, the authors described the experience of the members of the team to allow readers to gauge how their prior experience may influence their interpretation of the data. It's also helpful, I think, as piece of that, to have researchers with different experiences on the team. So not just all have PHM fellowship directors on the team, but to have PHM fellows, pediatric residents who have worked with PHM fellows, and maybe even someone outside of pediatric hospital medicine in overall. Sarah, other thoughts?
Well, I think listening to you, it's mostly amplifying what you've said, Suting. But what I really just appreciate about reflexivity and how I think about it is the permission, if you will, and acknowledgement of bias or perspective that researchers bring to the work. And in fact, that diversity of perspective is important. And again, this is in contrast to quantitative research, where we try to remove as much of the bias as possible.
So thank you, Suting and Sarah, for this really interesting discussion about qualitative research. We hope this will be helpful, as we know many of our readers and educators and trainees across the country are engaging in qualitative research more frequently. In wrapping up, we'd like to each share a few personal tips for those who want to engage in qualitative research. So I will go ahead and start. So my two biggest tips would be to work with someone experienced in qualitative research. As a new investigator, this guidance is critical at every step of study development, data analysis, and manuscript writing. And my second tip is to plan accordingly. Qualitative research takes a long, long time to do it well and to do it with rigor. And as long as you think it's going to take, it may take even longer. So please make sure you plan your timeline accordingly.
And my two tips are first, to check out the Standards for Reporting Qualitative Research, or SRQR, by O'Brien et al. In Academic Medicine in 2014. These standards reflect information essential for a qualitative research report, but shouldn't be viewed as a prescription for a rigid format or a standardized content, but I think can be a really helpful resource. And then second is to look at published qualitative articles in journals that you read or where you hope to publish to learn more, such as how they describe their methods or their interview guides, present their data, and integrate their quotes and other things.
So my tips are amplifying what Melissa said. You know, since qualitative research takes a lot longer than you think, you also want to find a diverse group of collaborators willing to spend that time in the data with you, do that together, and really to have that rich discussion around the data, because you're not always going to agree, and that's part of that reflexivity, and that's okay. The second piece is going back to what I said earlier, really explicitly describe the importance of your research question, detail the methodological rigor by which you conducted the study, and then justify how your results are meaningful and how they add to what's already known in the literature and move medical education forward. So thank you.
That was great. Thank you so much to the editorial team for discussing this article. And thank you to the authors for sharing these insights. What do the authors recommend based on these interviews? Well, one that I really spoke to me here is attending fellow dyads can pre-select intentional check-in times to run the list. Avoid hovering. There's a lot more good stuff. You're going to have to go to the article. There'll be links to the article as well as a lot of these methodologic references in the notes. And we will see you again in 2 weeks with another In the Moment. Have a good week.